From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The ground raid by the elite Navy SEAL Team 6 that killed Osama bin Laden was dramatic and dangerous, to be sure. But the journalist Mark Bowden was just as interested in the other part of the story, the part that involved years of intricate intelligence gathering, the part that included the decision-making process, the way those involved considered the odds and the stakes. Bowden sees the bin Laden raid as the end of a longer arc, the story of how the United States has slowly and gradually learned the lessons of how to fight terrorism in the 21st century, new tactics, new ways of thinking about the enemy. Today in the program, Bowden is joining us to talk about his book about the killing of bin Laden, from the dramatic moments of the raid itself to the way the story was spun and processed. It's called The Finish, after the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. By now, you've heard the dramatic story of the raid that led to the killing of Osama bin Laden, the heroic efforts of the SEAL Team 6, the carefully conceived and rehearsed plan. In his book, the journalist Mark Bowden gives vivid details to this mission. But as remarkable as that story is, he's even more interested in the events that led up to the moment. Bowden has said the raid was the last chapter of a longer and even more significant story. It includes the intelligence that discovered the mysterious compound in Abbottabad, Pakistan, the decision-making process, the way President Obama and others worked through the odds and the stakes. Bowden's also interested in how the raid is a kind of culmination of the lessons learned from the attacks on 9/11, what he's called the rapid transformation of warfighting tactics to cope with this new enemy. Today in the program, Mark Bowden is joining us to talk about his book. It's called The Finish, The Killing of Osama bin Laden. Mark Bowden is a national correspondent for The Atlantic and a contributing editor to Vanity Fair. He's the author of a number of books, including, of course, Black Hawk Down. And he's joining us today from a studio at the University of Delaware. And Mark Bowden, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Hey, thank you.
Well, I want to start in the book. You place all of the many of the players anyway in the story kind of in the setting of 9/11, the day of the attacks. President Obama, who's driving up Lakeshore Drive in Chicago, for example, and the Navy SEAL Captain Bill McRaven in a hospital bed. Why was it important to begin there?
Well, as you said in your summary, you know, I feel like the story of finding and killing Osama bin Laden was really a decade-long story. And in many ways encapsulates the experience that all of us as Americans have had over the last 10 years, which took a rather startling turn on September 11th of 2001. So I wanted to tell the story through the eyes of those who would be in this story at the end from, what is, from a storytelling standpoint anyway, the beginning.
Yeah. You yourself have talked about the fact that you had a kind of a sense on that day, 9/11, that your own life was being, I think you put it this way, being forcibly redirected. Yeah. So you yourself were kind of impacted by that. And I guess that bears on the way you think about the story or tell it anyway.
Well, it does. I mean, I think it was certainly the most traumatic direct attack on the United States in my lifetime, and that's getting to be a longer and longer phenomenon. And I think it changed the way all of us thought about our country and its role in the world. The previous sense of invulnerability that we had been shattered, and also that knowledge that we were facing an enemy that was different than those that we had faced in the past. I think it affected everybody. And I think that was shown, on the night that bin Laden was killed with the great outpouring of emotion all across the country.
Yeah. One of the things that your reporting on this has revealed is the interesting way the story has been told and played out in the media. And the number of misconceptions to the story is interesting. And we'll get to some of those as we go along. But broadly, what did that tell you about the way this story has played out, the fact that there were misconceptions and different kinds of interpretations of what actually happened?
Well, it didn't surprise me. I'm an old newspaper man, and I'm probably more acutely aware of how information gets reported in the country. And I think, the standard ways that we learn about things are from a storyteller's viewpoint, sort of backwards. Mm. We always find out about things at the end, in a way. And then we kind of work our way back to figure out how we arrived at that point. And that's what happened in the case of killing Osama bin Laden. There were, you know, the reports that he had been killed. And, of course, the immediate curiosity that everyone has is, well, exactly how did that happen? Who did it? And there's tremendous pressure on those in Washington in particular who know, you know, to explain. So some of those early explanations, as we see time and time again, were half true, mm-hmm. And were being immediately spun and interpreted. It's very easy to see how without of the full story and without a deeper sense of context, how, you know, a fact here, a fact there can spin out to create, you know, very misleading ideas about what exactly went on.
You met with the president to talk about this. You interviewed him for an hour and a half, I think it was. And you were there in the Oval Office. So before I get to the particulars of your conversation, I wanted to ask, what kind of effect does the Oval Office have on the way you, you know, conduct an interview? I mean, it has to be a little distracting or maybe even a little intimidating.
You know, I think any kind of awe from the surroundings disappears fairly quickly. Yeah. And I'd have to say President Obama is a very genuine and unaffected person. He makes you feel very comfortable. We had work to do. I had done a lot of work on this story before I met him. And I think my biggest concern, to be honest, was to make sure that I covered all of the vitally important parts of the story with him in the hour that had been set aside for this interview. I didn't want to leave the Oval Office smacking my head thinking, oh, God, you know, why didn't I ask him about this?
Right.
So that was my primary concern. And as it was, as it happened, you know, he was just a great interview, which just comes as no surprise. I mean, he's clearly been doing this for a long time. He understood what I needed, and he was very helpful and, in fact, extended our conversation half again as long. So, yeah. You know, I was not intimidated. I was more fascinated.
Yeah. Maybe you just got at that. But what is it in particular that you wanted from him? You were interested in, I guess, how he was sort of deliberating, how he was thinking about it. And were you looking for something else, kind of his, I don't know, personal kind of reaction to it all, the way he was thinking about it on a more personal basis?
I was. You know, you ask yourself when you interview someone, you know, what can this person give me that only this person can give me?
Yeah.
And of course, you know, as you look back over this story, there are many places where if I had not had the opportunity to ask President Obama directly, I would have had to speculate about his motives, about his thought process, about the weight that he gave, say, one piece of information versus another, how he felt about what was going on at any given point. And so, you know, my interview with him was an opportunity to ask him directly. I think the first question I asked him was that he had said previously, after the big decision meeting with all of his principal advisors, he left saying he would deliver his opinion in the following morning. So my first question was, well, what happened in the next 12 hours that, you know, how did you arrive at your opinion? And of course, at that point, he was the only person who could answer that.
Yeah. Didn't get much sleep that night, for sure.
That's what he said.
Yeah. One thing you write about is how the process that the president goes through to kind of deliberate. I mean, you've said you've been struck by his pragmatism, that he's interested in the advice of all kinds of different people. But you've said this. You said that in some ways he also keeps that advice at arm's length. Talk about what you mean.
Well, I think he is he's an intellectual. Yeah. You know, going back to his years as president of the Law Review at Harvard, his role was to weigh very cogent arguments on all sides of an issue. And I think, you know, he likes to take time, I think, to reflect on what he's just been told and to sort of weigh it through the prism of his own experience and his own values, which is what I think smart people do. And so if I, you know, were president of the United States, I would hope that I would take much the same approach, which is invite people to give me their opinions and explain thoroughly, you know, why they're giving the advice they're giving, and then give myself some time to reflect on all these things and figure out what I'm going to have to live with, which is, you know, the decision that I make.
Did it surprise you that some of this, some of the decisions that he came to sort of came down to, I guess, what amounted to kind of a gut feeling about certain people?
That's right. You know, I think that, you know, when Secretary of Defense Bob Gates, a very impressive person who has been through a lifetime of experiences at the top levels of intelligence agencies and the government and Defense Department, tells you, Mr. President, I think you should not, you know, send the SEALs in on this mission. And then, you know, you have someone like Admiral McRaven, who is the commander of JSOC, who's done these sorts of raids literally thousands of times, telling you, we can do this, Mr. President. It's, you know, it's risky, but, you know, I'm confident that we can do it. Ultimately, you know, it boils down to which of these two men how you feel about them. And, you know, it's not that he didn't respect Secretary Gates, but his level of confidence in Admiral McRaven was sufficient to override the objections raised and the fears that Secretary Gates expressed.
So there's a story that you tell, of course, that plays out in the Situation Room of the White House. It's May of 2009. President Obama had been president just 4 months now. And at the end of this sort of fairly routine briefing, the president points to some of the men who were there, among them Leon Panetta and Rahm Emanuel and Tom Donilon, his deputy national security advisor. And he says, you, come upstairs. I want to talk to you guys about something. Talk about what he says. This is kind of an important moment.
Yeah, I mean, this is the new president. These basically were the his chief of staff and his chief intelligence advisors or officers. And they had all settled into their jobs. And so he took a moment to address them all personally and tell them that his number one priority and their number one priority ought to be to find Osama bin Laden. He told them that he felt that the effort to find the leader of Al-Qaeda had gotten pushed aside, or at the very least had become one of a number of loud and competing priorities in the final term of the Bush administration, and that in his administration he wanted to make it very clear that this was his number one priority, and he wanted monthly progress reports.
You say the president, getting bin Laden was more than just symbolic. And you say the president saw bin Laden as not just evil, but charismatically evil, which I guess was another thing entirely for him.
Well, those were his words. Yeah. I think they're particularly significant because, you know, bin Laden had the capacity to inspire others. Right. The fact that he was still alive and at large years after this brutal attack on the United States was inspirational to many Islamist extremists throughout the Middle East and the Near East. And the president felt that, you know, it was really on that level of, you know, inspiration that bin Laden remained a very potent figure in the ongoing war against Islamist extremism and terrorism. So, I mean, he believed even if bin Laden were not a direct threat anymore, the indirect threat he posed was, in fact, the larger and more important one at that point. And, you know, and since he had focused on going after Al-Qaeda as the legitimate national defense priority of his administration, you know, getting bin Laden was the key.
The book is full of these moments where you kind of test some of these perceptions. You sort of temper some of these perceptions. There's one, for example, where when you talk about this particular meeting where the president says, you know, I want you guys to put this on the top of the priority, which sort of is this idea that the president now has created the momentum that leads to getting bin Laden, that he has, as you put it in the book, you know, resorted national defense priorities, given the hunt a new life, which I guess in some ways is true. But it also, it's a little more nuanced than that, because you talk about how the intelligence officials that you spoke with said it didn't really mean there was that big of a change. There was always this slow grind working at bin Laden.
That's right. You know, but I think you have to understand that the United States government and the pieces of it that deal with national defense and intelligence is vast.
Yeah.
And I do believe that there were intelligence analysts at CIA, at the National Center for Counterterrorism, for whom this had always been a burning priority. This was what they woke up thinking about in the morning and what they dreamed about when they went to bed at night. So I don't believe that for them this could have become a greater priority than it was. But I think at the higher levels, the people that they report to, there is, as many in the administration put it to me, a kind of limited bandwidth for information. And when you're fighting two wars, when one of the wars is increasingly spiraling out of control, something like the hunt for bin Laden or al-Zawahiri, his second in command, remains a very important thing, but it has to compete with these other priorities just for time during the day to sit and talk and think. So I think that, you know, it's subtle, but clearly when that kind of demand comes from the top, people who are the bosses of these intelligence analysts are a lot more concerned. And there is, I believe, a subtle effect. Michael Morell told me that when in any large organization you have to produce a monthly progress report, nobody wants to produce one that shows no progress.
So let's jump to this late summer, August of 2010. Tom Donilon, then, as I mentioned, the Deputy National Security Advisor, he tells the president that the guys at Langley, which he means, of course, the guys at the CIA, may have come up with something. Talk about this moment, because I guess finally they have what they think is a lead.
That's right. And the president wasn't sure at first how much weight to put on this, because as he knew, as I've just been describing, he had been leaning on them for these monthly reports and he wanted them to find something. And so he suspected, well, they're going to bring me some scrap that they found. And this, you know, involved having traced an individual who the CIA was interested in, who had the potential to be in bin Laden's inner circle, in his personal orbit. And they had traced him to a curious-looking compound in Abbottabad, which appeared to be harboring someone in secret. It was a fairly large compound, and there was a family hidden on this compound. So the fact that this fellow was potentially very close to bin Laden and that this compound appeared to be hiding someone, those were the two facts that they brought to the president.
Yeah. You say, he was kind of guarded. He'd learned to kind of keep his expectations under control. But did he reveal to you that he felt at all excited about the prospect?
You know, initially he said he was not.
Huh.
He was not going to allow himself to feel excited about it. And he was also not going to allow himself to think about taking action until he was more convinced that it was warranted. So his direction at that point was, well, bring me more information. We need to find out who this hidden family is. There were a lot of potential explanations for why someone would be hiding in that part of the world. So he directed them to come back to him when they had more information.
One thing that is really compelling in the story you tell is you write about the fact that they were noticing as they were watching this compound, they would see this figure who would take these walks around the vegetable garden in the compound. They called him the Pacer. Couldn't get a sense of look at his face because these were, you know, overhead shots, I guess by drones. They could tell he was thin and tall. But you've written that the president was kind of captivated by the video imagery of this Pacer strolling around. Did he look at that? Did he watch that from time to time then?
He did. They showed it to him in the Oval Office. And at the same time, I think what actually interested me, and I think probably affected the president's thinking a great deal, was that his chief counterterrorism advisor, John Brennan, had been involved with the hunt for bin Laden since the mid to late 1990s. And he had seen video shot from overhead of bin Laden walking, striding across the desert in Afghanistan. And we recognize people not just by their facial appearance, but by the way they move, by the way they walk. And Brennan was convinced when he saw this video of the pacer that this was the same person as the person he had seen years earlier in, you know, from high above in Afghanistan. So there was a growing sense of certainty among the people around the president that this pacer was bin Laden. And I think the fact that he could actually lay eyes on this person, who, and by appearance, you couldn't tell exactly who it was, but it certainly didn't contradict the idea that that could be bin Laden. He began to just feel that this was real, you know, and this was very, very possibly bin Laden himself.
It also gave me the sense that really it was going to come down to the fact that, and we'll get to the kind of the odds and the particulars as we go, but it seems like it was going to come down to the fact that they weren't going to be 100% certain, that you were going to have to operate in some way, the president was anyway, and all of the other people, on that some kind of hunch that they weren't going to get something certain.
Yeah. I mean, then that was obviously the big struggle for the first 6 months after they found this compound. And the president was hearing these estimates of certainty that were all over the map, everything from 95% certain from John Brennan and some of the CIA advisors to 40% certain from the analysts at the Center for Counterterrorism to Michael Morell, the deputy director of the CIA, who said, "Mr. President, I think that I would give it a 60% level of certainty." And, you know, the president told me that at a certain point he just decided all these numbers that people were assigning to their certainty were, in fact, methods of disguising uncertainty,
right,
as he put it.
Yeah.
And so he just made up his mind that unless something dramatically new presented itself, it was a 50-50 proposition. And he was willing to act on that percentage.
Mm. What's interesting also about this part of the story, that these odds, was that the people who were, you know, all over the map, the 30 and 40%, you talk about how they had learned from the search for Saddam Hussein's supposed weapons of mass destruction to be really, really wary and careful.
Yeah. I mean, and a lot of those folks, you know, have really been burned by the mistake that they made in finding that there were weapons of mass destruction inside Iraq. Michael Morell, in particular, was the chief of analysis for the CIA when that finding was presented to President Bush. And so as he told the president, he didn't believe that he would ever be more than 60% certain about any piece of intelligence for the rest of his life, because he had been more certain about there being weapons of mass destruction in Iraq than he was about the identity of this pacer was bin Laden. Others who have had more luck with intelligence analyses in recent years, some of the younger analysts who have had a lot of luck and a lot of success targeting al-Qaeda figures in the past 5 or 6 years, their confidence levels were very high. They'd never been burned in the same way that Morell and some of the others have been.
Mark Bowden is with us. His book is called The Finish, The Killing of Osama Bin Laden. We'll take a brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, the journalist Mark Bowden is our guest. He, of course, wrote the bestseller Black Hawk Down. His latest book tells the story of the killing of Osama bin Laden. Though it's not just the dramatic details of the mission itself, Bowden was interested in the longer arc of that story, the way the intelligence was gathered and the decision made and the way the mission was spun. His book is called The Finish, The Killing of Osama bin Laden. He's joining us today from a studio at the University of Delaware. So, Mark Bowden, we know at this point that bin Laden had been in that compound, I guess, in Abbottabad for some 6 years by the spring of 2011. And you write about how his world was exceedingly narrow. What is it we learned about Osama bin Laden? I guess he's isolated, but still relevant as a figure.
He was. He was communicating with his lieutenants in his organization by these long letters, which he was continually writing on a little keyboard in that house. And his associate, who the CIA eventually learned is they called Ahmed the Kuwaiti, would take those letters or flash drives and deliver them to another courier, and would deliver to yet another and another, sort of a drop system that would disguise where it had originated. And these letters would find them their way to the people who were hiding in Waziristan or al-Qaeda figures throughout the region who would take orders. And some of the orders that bin Laden was giving were, you know, about very specific things, promoting people to fill jobs vacated by successful drone strikes or directing them to hold hostages for a longer period of time, wait for certain conditions to evolve, or directing them to kill hostages in certain instances, even, you know, offering very specific instructions on how to live and how to move safely in those parts of the world there where, you know, they were very much under surveillance and attack.
It's interesting you write about how his day really consisted of these very familiar routines, meals, and then there were seven prayer sessions, and then there was time with the kids and three of his wives. But we also, you write about the fact that, you know, there's this kind of perception that bin Laden always had been portrayed as living kind of in luxury. But in the book, you say this impression missed an important point. And you write this, you write that by all indications, bin Laden's lifestyle by choice was a far sight below the average American middle-class citizen. Why is that important?
Well, it corrects a misconception, number one, but also it illustrates his personality. You know, bin Laden made a decision even just as a teenager to become a jihadi, a holy warrior. And he lived his whole life either on the run in the mountains of Afghanistan or, you know, preparing to take off at any moment and live in that way. He was a dedicated ascetic. And that, too, was a reflection of the sort of general narrowing of his view of the world. He accepted this very strict interpretation of Islam, an extremist interpretation, which dictated, you know, a sort of pre-modern way of life. And he adopted that wholeheartedly. He eschewed, you know, all of the conveniences and comforts, most of them, of modern life, except for those that helped facilitate the jihad.
Yeah. He was hiding from everyone. You said he didn't, I guess, really trust anyone, not his family, not his neighbors. You said he had no place in the world where there were very many people who really revered him.
That's right. He increasingly walled himself off, and he had walled himself off from a philosophical standpoint in that he basically stopped learning at a certain point and had no interest in other people, other religions, other cultures, other parts of the world, other ways of looking at things. He had one very strict, carefully defined way of viewing the world, one goal, and in the whole course of his life is one of both by necessity and choice, narrowing his, drawing a tighter and tighter circle around his life. Mm.
So basically, it comes down to these two kind of broad options to get at this compound. One is to bomb it, and the other is to do a ground raid. And I wanted to talk about the bombing option because this kind of leads us to another misconception that you clear up in the book. The bombing option, you know, meant for a lot of people think, well, then you're going to have this huge bombing operation, which would naturally kill everyone in the compound and possibly even others nearby. But it was more complicated than that because you write about there was an idea from General James Cartwright to use a drone and be very precise – precisely shoot a missile, a small missile, at the pacer, at bin Laden, as he's going on one of these walks around the garden. Talk about that, because it's pretty risky, this idea.
It is. You know, President Obama, I think to his credit, ruled out the possibility of a large bombing attack right away, because there were just simply too many women and children living on that compound, people living nearby. And their certainty level about bin Laden even being there was, as I said, only 50-50. So he said, if you can't bring me back something more precise than this, then, you know, we're not going to attack from the air. So they came back with this extraordinarily precise weapon. And the risky piece of this was that it was relatively untested. This was just a small drone, like a toy airplane, really, that would never be spotted by Pakistan's radar. It fired a missile about the size of my forearm. If it hit the target, it would kill him. But there would be no way of knowing for certain that it had been bin Laden they killed. And there was always the 50-50 chance that they'd killed some poor unfortunate. If they missed the target, clearly, if it was bin Laden, he would vanish. So that option, while it risked no American forces, it didn't risk any confrontation with Pakistan. It was the least intrusive of the methods that the president could have employed. And clearly, I think, for that reason, a very tempting option, brought with it a level of uncertainty about success, whether you had in fact killed bin Laden, and also the concern over whether or not the missile would hit the target.
Mm. It brings us to another once again, to one of these major characters in the story, Admiral Bill McRaven. Again, President Obama has this gut feeling about him. And McRaven thinks the decision to do a ground raid with the SEALs is kind of a slam dunk. I mean, he talks about that this is the way to go. We've done this before. This is one of the lessons we've learned over the past 10 years or so. And he didn't seem terribly worried about the fact that they could do this. He had this kind of supreme confidence that this was absolutely the way to go.
Yeah. And the only thing that he was uncertain about, and as he put it, that would get kind of sporty,
right,
was getting his men in and out of Pakistan without alerting that nation's defenses. And, you know, Pakistan is not an unsophisticated country. They have ground-to-air missiles. They have, you know, radar anti-intrusion technology. They have a fairly sophisticated air force with F-16s and a modern army. You know, this was a four-hour military incursion into their sovereign territory, and it had to be done without tripping any alarms. And so, that was the one thing that concerned Admiral McRaven. As far as hitting the compound was concerned, he had personally taken part in and commanded so many missions like it that he could see immediately that it was, you know, a relatively easy job. His men would have no difficulty pulling it off, even if they were fired upon or confronted in an effort to do it.
Mm. This was a new kind of fighting force. This is the thing that I guess the military had learned, that experience after 9/11, the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. They were used to doing incursions like this.
They were. I mean, the challenge posed by al-Qaeda was finding them.
Yeah.
Once they found them, it was never very difficult, or they'd gotten so good at it, it was not terribly difficult to kill them or capture them. You know, the problem in the Cold War was always not, you know, where are our enemies? I mean, they were, you know, arrayed out on battlefields, thousands of tanks or in missile silos. The problem was, you know, killing them, successfully attacking them. Al-Qaeda posed exactly the opposite problem, and it's one that the United States had, over the previous 10 years, had gotten very, very good at dealing with.
Mm. So ultimately, the president goes with the ground raid, and so the rehearsals really began in early April, first on the grounds of Fort Bragg, where you write about they had built this this mock-up of the Abbottabad compound. How detailed was that? How close to the actual place did they get, do you figure?
Well, this is one of the things that they are not eager to be very precise about, but I believe they had an exact replica of the compound. I think that they were capable of mapping the interior of that structure, that they knew, for instance, that there was a metal door blockading off the upper two floors that would have to be blown off its hinges. I think they even knew which direction those hinges turned.
Wow.
So in order to have that level of knowledge, they would have had to have had technology capable of, you know, mapping the inside of the house. So I think they built something that was a replica of what these men would be attacking when they got to Abbottabad.
Mm. And, of course, they also practiced in Nevada, where the heat and the altitude were somewhat similar to Abbottabad. But this is kind of where they made one mistake.
Right.
Talk about that, if you would.
Well, they had rehearsed multiple times, you know, taking down the compound itself in North Carolina. And so when they went out to Nevada, it was not to once again, you know, rehearse the takedown of the compound itself. It was more an effort to rehearse, you know, the travel time that the Blackhawks would have to use, an hour and a half to fly from Abbottabad, heavily loaded, and then come to a hover over this compound in Abbottabad. And so they, out in Nevada, they reenacted the entire mission, but they did not build an exact replica of the compound. And they just used Connex containers to sort of flesh out the general configuration of the house. And instead of building a stone wall around the compound, they just put up a chain-link fence. Well, the chain-link fence was turned out to be a critical error because of the heat from this heavily laden a helicopter arriving after an hour and a half flight dissipated readily through the chain link fence in Nevada. But when it actually arrived on target in Abbottabad, the stone wall trapped that heat from the helicopter and very quickly, you know, decreased the density of the air under the helicopter, which made it incapable of sustaining a hover. In fact, it sent it into a controlled crash inside the compound.
Describe the Situation Room, if you would. It's kind of like a bunker in the basement of the White House, I guess.
It is, you know, and what's really surprising when you go there is, you know, we have from Hollywood, I guess, these images, one of which comes to mind, scene from Dr. Strangelove where they're in the war room, you know, and it's like arena-sized space with big screens on the walls. The actual Situation Room is about the size of most people's living room. It's totally dominated by a large wooden table with chairs all around it. And it has screens at one end of the room and room for advisors or deputies to sit on chairs around behind the chairs at the dining room table. But if you've ever been at a big family dinner with 20 or 30 people jammed into a small room around a big dining room table, you pretty much have the feel of the White House Situation Room.
Mm. I wanted to ask you about Vice President Biden, because in the end, he was really the only one who had advised against taking the action in the way they did. What do you think that revealed about him? Because you say he never really hesitated to disagree at meetings like this.
Yeah. Well, I think in part it helps to understand that President Obama has asked his vice president to be aggressively skeptical or critical of what appears to be the overriding consensus. And yeah. So I think there's a disposition on the part of Vice President Biden to challenge the thinking in the room. And most of the thinking in the room was that they needed to attack this compound. They needed to either send in the SEALs or fire this missile. And Vice President Biden took the position that they didn't, that 50-50 wasn't good enough.
Yeah.
Given the downside of potentially getting into a shooting war with Pakistan, destroying our diplomatic ties with that country, the potential loss of life of the SEAL team going into the country, and also the political consequences. Mm-hmm. If anybody in the room were going to be giving the president political advice, it would be his running mate.
Yeah.
And Vice President Biden was not shy about saying, Mr. President, you realize if this fails, you can write off a second term. You're not going to get reelected. So he was playing.
Do you think he was right,
by
the way?
Advocate.
Do you think he was right about
Oh, without
that?
A doubt. Yeah. I think if this mission had failed, it would have, and there's many different sort of spectacular ways that it could have failed, one of which was, as I mentioned, getting in a shooting war with our ostensible ally, Pakistan. Mm. It would have been seen as a, you know, major embarrassment for the intelligence agencies and the military. And I think it would have confirmed a lot of the, frankly, misconceptions about Obama as a kind of inept and pacifist president in the national defense sphere.
Which kind of leads us to the way you have kind of redeemed the perception of Jimmy Carter, how he rolled the dice on this incredible long shot to try and free the American hostages in Iran. And you've said that the book in some way that you've written completes an arc that began with that failed raid in 1979.
It did. I mean, in fact, Secretary Gates was in the White House in the Situation Room back in 1980 when that mission failed. I've always felt, you know, people, there's sort of this widespread idea that Jimmy Carter was this timid president. I don't know of a military mission that was more daring and risked more than the effort to rescue the hostages in Iran. The fact is it failed, and there were, you know, a million different ways it could have failed. In this case, it failed right away. But, you know, I don't think it's fair to say that Jimmy Carter wasn't a fairly bold president. Where I don't think there's many presidents who would have done what he did.
Mark Bowden is with us. His book is called The Finish, The Killing of Osama Bin Laden. And we need to take another brief break. We'll be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with Mark Bowden. We're talking about his book, The Finish, The Killing of Osama Bin Laden. I wanted to ask you about one of the details that you write about there in the Situation Room that I found so particular and interesting, that there was actually some question about whether the president should be watching the video feed of the raid.
Yeah. There was concern, mostly, I think, by Tom Donilon, who is his national security advisor, that if the president were to be watching the video feed of the raid as it took place, that he might later be accused of having micromanaged the mission. You know, it's commonplace nowadays for generals and admirals to watch raids like the one to Abbottabad on a screen and be able to communicate directly with the men on the ground. And there are men involved in some of these missions who don't like it very much, who deal sometimes with commanders who are essentially telling them, take a left turn here, you know, jump over that fence instead of go around it, you know, giving them very precise commands from afar. So they just wanted to make sure that the president wasn't going to be in a position to be accused of having done that.
But he said, you know, forget that, I'm watching this, because he obviously did.
Right. He did, yeah. I mean, they had the video up in a side room just off of the Situation Room, a much smaller little conference room. And I think that the president wasn't aware at first that he could watch it. He was sitting in the Situation Room and they'd blacked out the video and on the big screens there. And when he heard that the video feed was being shown in the next room, he just walked over and took a chair in the corner of the room. And being president of the United States, no one told him he had to leave.
Right. And I have to say, you gave some context for that famous photo that we've all seen of President Obama and Hillary Clinton and Joe Biden and others in that little room watching that feed. The picture comes, I have to say, I hadn't realized, it comes from the moments just after that one helicopter went down. So things weren't resolved when they were sort of scowling at the image in front of them.
No, when you understand what they were looking at, you understand the expressions of concern on their faces, because they knew and they'd been briefed in enough detail to know that the two helicopters were supposed to hover over the compound and rope SEAL teams in. One team was going to go down to the roof and the other was going to rope down to the ground inside the compound, and they were going to assault the house from above and below simultaneously. So when this first Black Hawk, you know, tries to hover and instead crashes in the middle of the compound, they couldn't actually tell that it had crashed. All they could tell from the video feed was that the helicopter had gone down inside the walls of the compound, which was not supposed to happen. Yeah. So at that moment, they're all seeing that, and they know that something unexpected has happened. They don't know yet what it means, whether it's a disaster or whether they just changed the plan at the last minute. So they're waiting to hear what just happened.
Yeah. And this is an important question. Could the SEALs have taken bin Laden alive if they wanted to? Because you say in the book, if their first priority had been to take him alive, he'd be in U.S. custody today.
Yeah, without a doubt. I mean, and with the comfort of hindsight, sitting here in a very warm, quiet place where no one is shooting at me, I can tell you that they could have taken him alive. Basically, they shot and killed the Ahmed the Kuwaiti, the one male resident of the compound who fired at them when they first approached. And after that, the only shots fired for the next 15 minutes were shots fired by the SEALs as they methodically made their way through the house. So, I mean, 15 minutes is long enough to ascertain that it's unlikely that they're going to be that the building is going to blow up. It seems to me have enough presence of mind if you chose to proceed cautiously before shooting someone.
Yeah.
In the case in point, though, these men had been fired upon. Their adrenaline is pumping, as you can only imagine it would be. And they had to, I think, proceed with the expectation that they were going to be fired upon again. Mm. Their first priority, understandably, is to come out of this mission alive. So having been fired upon once, I think that the fate of every adult male in that house was sealed. They were, not to unintentionally pun, but they were going to go through that house, and they were very discerning.
Yeah.
They only, with the exception of one woman who got caught apparently in the fire, were aiming at and shooting the adult males they encountered. And I think that was just on the basis of, we're not going to wait and see,
yeah,
you know, whether this person is going to shoot at us or not. As it happened, none of them were even armed.
Which is among the misperceptions that we sort of come to, that one of them was that there was a firefight. There wasn't really, you write about. There was only one of the six adults in the compound that were actually armed. The question of whether bin Laden actually resisted, not really. He didn't. He wasn't, as you say, not actively surrendering, but he wasn't actively resisting either. That the men didn't, in fact, use women as human shields. No children were harmed. Only one of the three women who was shot there that night was actually killed. And this question of these misperceptions sort of comes to how the way the story was spun. In the book, you write about how while the president credited the efforts of the intelligence team and the counterterrorism professionals and, of course, the SEALs themselves, but you say he also reserved a large share of the credit for himself. And you write about how that's only fair, but that once you got the sort of political professionals involved, this in some way may have been how we got to some of the misconceptions, do you think?
It was, and I don't think this was a concerted or coordinated effort on the part of the White House. I think it was more a cumulative effect of what the individuals who were telling the story in those first hours brought to it. First of all, they brought incomplete knowledge. Secondly, they brought their own biases. John Brennan, who was, I think, personally responsible for a number of the misconceptions, had a very deep and abiding animus for Osama bin Laden. It was a personal thing with him. He'd been trying to find and kill this man for 15 years. And, you know, he seized upon every little bit of evidence to portray bin Laden as a hypocrite, as someone who was living in luxury, someone who used his wives to shield him, who was a coward.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that was a reflection of his own bias against bin Laden, for lack of a better way of putting it. And then there was also a desire on the part of those in the administration to make sure that no one missed the point that this was President Barack Obama's triumph, that he had, you know, redirected the government's, the United States efforts, that he had personally intervened in the planning of the mission in a way that, you know, made it more likely to succeed, you know, that he handled this all very brilliantly. And as I put in the book, I think, you know, there are certain accomplishments that need no dressing up.
Yeah.
And yet there was, I think, an effort on the part of some of those involved to sort of dress up something that really did not need to be spun or sold.
Mm. On the Friday after the raid, you write about how the president flew to Fort Campbell, Kentucky, to meet with the SEAL team and with the chopper pilots. We got an email from one of our listeners, Thad, who writes about the SEALs that were involved, and he says they seem uniquely self-disciplined. What is it that makes these people able to do these difficult tasks day after day? Because you write about that. You write about how the president was struck by his impressions as how ordinary they seemed.
Yeah, you know, they don't pick these guys for these units because they look like the Hollywood version of themselves. In fact, that may actually work against some applicants. They want people who blend in, who are not eager to draw attention to themselves, who are have a selfless quality to them, more interested in accomplishing the mission than necessarily getting credit for it. So the ideals of the units, whether we're talking about Delta Force or the SEALs, is this sort of selfless, silent warrior. Mm. As we've seen, these men, you know, don't always live up in all respects to this ideal, but they are very heroic, capable men. They are probably their chief skill is an ability not to panic and to be able to think very clearly, to make quick decisions in a very fast-moving, dangerous situation. And these skills have been you aren't speculating anymore about these guys. They've been doing it for almost a decade.
That's Mark Bowden. His book is called The Finish, The Killing of Osama Bin Laden. He joined us from a studio at the University of Delaware. Mark, thanks very much.
You're welcome, Doug. My pleasure.
Radio West, a production of KUER News. Our thanks to Taylor Almond. Technical direction from Mike Anderson. The show produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.